dimming the sun again. Its shadow cut across the path in front of them.
"We'll split up." Craiglin looked around. "I'll go that way with Avager and Jandro Ligeli. Halls are alone, you go that way."
He pointed to one side.
"That's leading down to one of the side prows. There ought to be something there, just keep looking."
He touched a wrist button.
"Yelson?"
"Hello?"
Yelson said of the intercom. She, Wobslin and Dorolo had watched Lenipobra's body being winched up to the shuttle and then left, following the rest.
"Right," Craiglin said, looking at one of the helmet screens. "You're only about 300 meters away."
He turned and looked back the way they had come. A collection of towers some kilometers away were strung out behind them now, mostly starting at higher levels. They could see more and more of the Olmedreka. Mist streamed quietly past them in the silence.
"Oh, yeah," Craiglin said. "I see you."
He waved. Some small figures on a distant deck at the side of one of the great mist-filled bowls waved back.
"I see you too," Yelson said.
"When you get to where we are now, head over to the left for the other side prow. There are subsidiary lasers there. Horza and Lamb will..."
"Yeah, we heard," Yelson said.
"Right. We'll be able to bring the shuttle closer. Maybe right down to wherever we find anything soon. Let's go. Keep your eyes open."
He nodded at Avager and Jandro Ligeli, and they went forward. Lamb and Horza looked at each other, then set off in the direction Craiglin had indicated. Lamb motioned to Horza to switch off his communicator transmit and open his visor.
"If we'd waited, we could have put the shuttle down where we wanted to in the first place," he said with his own visor open.
Horza agreed.
"Stupid little bastard," Lamb said.
"Who?"
asked Horza. "That kid, jumping off the goddamn platform."
"Know what I'm gonna do?"
Lamb looked at the changer.
"What?"
"I'm gonna cut that stupid little bastard's tongue out. That's what I'm gonna do. A tattooed tongue should be worth something, shouldn't it? Little bastard owed me money anyway. What do you think? How much do you think it'd be worth?"
"No idea."
"Little bastard," Lamb muttered.
The two men tramped along the deck, angling away from the dead-ahead line they had taken previously. It was difficult to tell where exactly they were heading, but according to Craiglin, it was toward one of the side prows, which stuck out like enormous outriggers attached to the Olmedreka and formed harbours for the liners which had shuttled to and from the megaship in its heyday on excursions or working as tenders. They passed where there had evidently been a recent firefight. Laser burns, smashed glass and torn metal littered an accommodation section of the ship, and torn curtains and wall hangings flapped in the steady breeze of the great ship's progress. Two of the small wheeled vehicles lay smashed on their sides nearby. They crunched over the debris and kept walking. The other two groups were heading forward too, making reasonable progress according to their reports and chatter. Ahead of them, there still lay the enormous bank of cloud they had seen earlier. It wasn't growing any thinner or lower, and they could only be a couple of kilometers from it now, though distances were hard to estimate.
"We're here," Craiglin said eventually, his voice crackling in Hawes's ear.
Lamb turned his transmit channel on.
"What?"
He looked mystified at Horza, who shrugged.
"What's keeping you two?" Craiglin said. "We had further to walk. We're at the main bows. They stick further out than the bit you're on."
"The hell you are, Craiglin,"
Yelson broke in from the other team, which was supposed to be heading for the opposite set of side prows.
"What?"
Craiglin said. Lamb and Horza stopped to listen to the exchange over their communicators. Yelson spoke again.
"We've just come to the edge of the ship. In fact, I think we're a bit out from the main side or on some sort of wing or buttress. Anyway, there's no side prow around here. You've sent us in the wrong direction."
"But you..."
Craiglin began. His voice died away.
"Craiglin, dammit, you've sent us toward the bow and you're on a side prow."
Lamb yelled into his helmet mic. Horza had been coming to the same conclusion. That was why they were still walking and Craiglin's team had reached the bows. There was silence from the clear air turbulence as captain for a few seconds. Then he said,
"Shit, you must be right."
They could hear him sigh.
"I guess you and Horza had better keep going. I'll send somebody down in your direction once we've had a quick look round there. I think I can see some sort of gallery with a lot of transparent blisters where there might be some lasers. Yelson, you head back to where we split up and tell me when you get there. We'll see who comes up with something useful first."
"Fucking marvellous," Lamb said, stamping off into the mist.
Horza followed, wishing the ill-fitting suit didn't rub so much. The two men walked on. Lamb stopped to investigate some staterooms which had already been looted. Fine materials snagged on broken glass floated like the cloud around them. In one apartment, they saw rich wooden furniture, a holosphere lying broken in a corner, and a glass-sided water tank the size of a room, full of rotting, brilliantly coloured fish and fine clothes, floating together on the surface like exotic weeds. Over their communicators, Hawser and Lamb heard the others in Craiglin's group find what they thought was a door leading to the gallery where, they hoped, they would find lasers behind the transparent bubbles they had seen earlier. Hawser told Lamb they had best not waste their time, and so they left the staterooms and went back out onto the deck to continue heading forward.
"Hi, Hawser," Craiglin said, as the Changer and Lamb walked along the deck and into a long tunnel lit by dim sunlight coming through mist and opaque ceiling panels.
"This needle radar's not working properly,"
Hawser answered as they walked.
"What's wrong?" "It isn't going through cloud, that's what's wrong. I never really got a chance to..."
"What do you mean?" Hawser stopped in the corridor. He felt something wrong in his guts.
Lamb kept walking away from him down the corridor. "It's given me a reading off that big cloud in front, right the way along and about half a K up."
Craiglin laughed.
"It isn't the edge wall, that's for sure, and I can see that's a cloud, and it's closer than the needle says it is."
"Where are you now?"
Dorolo broke in.
"Did you find any lasers? What about that door?"
"No, just a sort of sun lounge or something," Craiglin said.
"Craiglin," Hawser shouted, "are you sure about that reading?"
"I'm sure. The needle says, sure isn't much fucking sun to lounge," somebody broke in, though it sounded as if it was accidental and they didn't know the transmit was on.
Hawser felt sweat start out on his brow. Something was wrong.
"Lamb," he shouted.
Lamb, 30 meters away down the corridor, turned as he walked and looked back.
"Come back," Hawser shouted.
Lamb stopped.
"Hawser, there can't be anything.
Craiglin."
This time it was Mip's voice, calling from the shuttle.
"There was somebody else here. I just saw another craft take off somewhere behind where we landed. They've gone now."
"Okay, thanks, Mip," Craiglin said, his voice calm.
"Listen, Hawser, from what I can see from here, the bows where you are have just gone into the cloud.
So it's a cloud.
Shit. We can all see it's a goddamn cloud, don't..."
The ship shuddered under Hawser's feet. He rocked. Lamb looked at him puzzled.
"Did you feel that?" Hawser shouted.
"Feel what?" Craiglin said.
"Craiglin," it was Mip again.
"I can see something..." "Lamb, get back here!" Hawser shouted through the air and into his helmet mic together.
Lamb looked around him. Hawser thought he could feel a continuing tremor in the deck below.
"What did you feel?"
Craiglin said. He was starting to get annoyed.
Yalson chipped in. "I thought I felt something. Nothing much, but... Listen, these things aren't supposed to... They aren't supposed to..."
"Craiglin," Mip said more urgently. "I think I can see... Lamb!"
Hawser was backing off now, back down the long tunnel of corridor. Lamb stayed where he was, looking hesitant. Hawser could hear something. A curious growling noise. It reminded him of a jet engine or a fusion motor heard from a very long distance away, but it wasn't either. He could feel something under his feet, too, that tremor, and there was some sort of pull, a tug that seemed to be dragging him forward, toward Lamb, toward the bows, as though he was in a weak field, or...
"Craiglin!" Mip yelled. "I can't... There is...
He spluttered.
"Look, will you all just calm down?"
"I can feel something,"
Yalson began. Hawser started running, pounding back down the corridor. Lamb, who had started to walk back, stopped and put his hands on his hips when he saw the other man running away from him. There was a distant roaring in the air, like a big waterfall heard from far down a gorge.
"I can feel something too. It's as if..." What was Mip yelling about?
"We're crashing," Hawser shouted as he ran. The roaring was coming closer, growing stronger all the time.
"Ice!"
It was Mip.
"I'm bringing the shuttle. Run. It's a wall of ice. Nicen, where are you? Nicen, I've got..."
"What? Ice?"
The roaring noise grew. The corridor around Hawser started to groan. Several of the opaque roof panels fractured and fell to the floor in front of him. A section of wall suddenly sprang out like an opening door, and he just avoided running into it. The noise filled his ears. Lamb looked round and saw the end of the corridor coming toward him. The whole end section was closing off steadily with a grinding roar, advancing toward him at about running speed. He fired at it, but it didn't stop. Smoke poured into the corridor. He swore, turned and ran, following Hawser. People were yelling and shouting from all over now. There was a babble of tiny voices in both Hawser's ears, but all he could really hear was the thundering noise behind him. The deck beneath his feet bucked and trembled as though the whole gigantic ship was a building caught in an earthquake. The plates and panels which made up the corridor walls were buckling. The floor rose up in places. More roof panels shattered and fell. All the time, the same sapping force was pulling him back, slowing him down, as though he was in a dream. He ran out into daylight, heard Lam not far behind.
"Crichlin, you stupid motherfucking son of a bitch's bastard!" Lam screamed.
The voices yammered in his ear, his heart pounded. He threw each foot forward with all his might, but the roaring was coming closer, growing stronger. He ran past the empty staterooms, where the soft materials blew. The roof was starting to fold in on the apartments and the deck was tilting. The holosphere they had seen earlier came rolling and bouncing out of the collapsing windows. A hatch near Horza blew out in a gust of pressurized air and flying debris. He ducked as he ran, felt splinters strike his suit. He skidded as the deck under him banged and leapt. Lam's steps came pounding behind him. Lam continued to scream abuse at Crichlin over the intercom. The noise behind him was like a gigantic waterfall, a big rock slide, like a continuous explosion, a volcano. His ears ached and his mind reeled, stunned by the volume of the racket. A line of windows set in the wall ahead of him went white, then exploded toward him, throwing particles at his suit in a series of small, hard clouds. He put his head down again. He headed for the doorway.
"Bastard, bastard, bastard!" Lam bellowed.
"Not stopping. Over here!"
"Shut up, Lam!"
"Hosa!"
Voices screamed in his ear. He was running on carpet now, inside a broad corridor. Open doors were flapping. Light fittings on the ceiling were vibrating. Suddenly, a deluge of water swept across the corridor in front of him. 20 meters away, and for a second he thought he was at sea level, but knew he couldn't be. When he ran over the place where the water had been, he could see and hear it frothing and gurgling down a broad spiral stairwell, and only a few dribbles were falling from overhead. The tugging of the slowly decelerating ship seemed less now, but the roar of noise was still all around him. He was weakening, running in a daze, trying to keep his balance as the long corridor vibrated and twisted around him. Now a rush of air was flowing past him. Some sheets of paper and plastic flapped past him like coloured birds.
"Bastard, bastard, bastard! Lam!"
There was daylight ahead, through a glassed-over sundeck of broad windows. He jumped through some big-leaved plants growing in large pots and landed in a group of flimsy chairs set round a small table, demolishing them.
"Fucking stupid bastard! Lam, shut up!"
Craiglin's voice broke in.
"We can't hear."
The line of windows ahead went white, cracking like ice, then bursting out. He dived through the space to skid over the fragments scattered on the deck beyond. Behind him, the top and bottom of the shattered windows started to close slowly like a huge mouth.
"You bastard, you motherfucker! Damn it, change channels, go to..."
He slipped on the shards of glass, almost falling. Only Lam's voice sounded through his helmet now, filling his ears with oaths which were mostly drowned in the smothering roar of the endless wreck behind. He looked back, just for a second, to see Lam throwing himself between the jaws of the crumpling windows. He careened over the deck, falling and rolling, then rising again, still holding his gun, as Horza looked away. It was only at that point he realized he no longer had his own gun. He must have dropped it, but he couldn't remember where or when. Horza was slowing down. He was fit and strong, but the above-standard pull of Vavach's false gravity and the badly fitting suit were taking their toll. He tried, as he ran in something like a trance, as his breath streamed back and forth through his wide-open mouth, to imagine how close they had been to the bows, for how long that immense weight of ship behind would be able to compress its front section as its billion-ton mass rammed into what must, if it had filled the cloud bank they had seen earlier, be a massive, tabular iceberg. As though in a dream, Horza could see the ship about him, still wrapped in clouds and mist, but lit from above by the wash of golden sunlight. The towers and spires seemed unaffected. The whole vast structure still sliding forward toward the ice as the kilometres of megaship behind them pressed forward with the vessel's own titanic momentum. He ran by game courts, past tents of billowing silver, through a pile of musical instruments. Ahead there was a huge tiered wall of more decks, and above him were bridges, swaying and thrashing as the bowward supports out of sight behind him came closer to the advancing wave of wreckage and were consumed. He saw the deck to one side drop away into airy, hazy nothing. The deck under his feet started to rise slowly, but for 15 meters or more in front of him. He was fighting his way up a slope, growing steeper all the time. A suspension bridge to his left collapsed, wires flailing. It disappeared into the golden mist, the noise of its fall lost in the crushing din assaulting his ears. His feet started to slide on the tilt of deck. He fell, landed heavily on his back and turned, looking behind him. Against a wall of pure white towering higher than the Olmedrecker's tallest spire, the megaship was throwing itself to destruction in a froth of debris and ice. It was like the biggest wave in the universe rendered in scrap metal, sculpted in grinding junk, and beyond and about it, over and through, cascades of flashing, glittering ice and snow swept down in great slow veils from the cliff of frozen water beyond. Hawser stared at it, then started to slide down toward it as the deck tilted him. To his left, a huge tower was collapsing slowly, bowing to the breaking wave of compacted wreckage like a slave before a master. Hawser felt a scream start in his throat as he saw decks and railings, walls and bulkheads and frames he'd only just run past start to crumple and smash and come toward him. He rolled over sliding shards and skidding fragments to the buckling rail at the edge of the deck, grabbed at the rails, caught them, heaved with both arms, kicked with one foot and threw himself over the side. He fell only one deck, crashing into sloped metal, winding himself. He got to his feet as fast as he could, sucking air through his mouth and swallowing as he tried to get his lungs to work. The narrow deck he was on was also buckling, but the fold point was between him and the wall of towering, grinding wreckage. He slipped and slid away from it, down the sloping surface as the deck behind him rose into a peak. Metal tore, and girders crashed out of the deck above like broken bones through skin. A set of steps faced him, leading to the deck he'd just jumped from, but to an area that was still level. He scrambled up to the level deck, which only then started to tip, canting away from the wavefront of debris as its front edge lifted, crumpling. He ran down the increasing slope, water from shallow ornamental pools cascading around him. More steps. He hauled himself toward the next deck. His chest and throat seemed filled with hot coals, his legs with molten lead, and all the time that awful nightmarish pull came from behind, dragging him back toward the wreckage. He stumbled and gasped his way from the top of the steps past the side of a broken, drained swimming pool.
"Hawser!" a voice yelled. "Is that you, Hawser? It's Mip! Look up!"
Hawser lifted his head. In the mist, 30 meters above him, was the cat's shuttle. He waved weakly at it, staggering as he did so. The shuttle lowered itself through the mist ahead of him, its rear doors opening until it was hovering just over the next deck above.
"I've opened the doors! Jump in!" Mip shouted.
Hawser tried to reply, but could produce no sound apart from a sort of rasping wheeze. He staggered on, feeling as though the bones in his legs had turned to jelly. The heavy suit bumped and crashed around him, his feet slipped on the broken glass which covered the thrumming deck under his boots. Yet more steps towered ahead, leading to the deck where the shuttle waited.
"Hurry up, Hawser! I can't wait much longer!"
He threw himself at the steps, hauled himself up. The shuttle wavered in the air, swiveling, its open rear ramp pointing at him, then away. The steps beneath him shuddered. The noise around him roared, full of screams and crashes. Another voice was shouting in his ears, but he couldn't make out the words. He fell onto the upper deck, lunged forward for the shuttle ramp a few meters away. He could see the seats and lights inside, Lenny Pobre's suited body slumped in one corner.
"I can't wait, I've..."
Mip shouted above the scream of the wreckage and the other shouting voice. The shuttle started to rise. Hawser threw himself at it. His hands caught the lip of the ramp just as it rose level with his chest. He was hoisted from the deck, swinging under outstretched arms and looking forward under the shuttle's fuselage belly as the craft forced its way up into the air.
"Hawser, Hawser, I'm sorry,"
Mip sobbed.
"You've got me,"
Hawser yelled hoarsely.
"What?"
The shuttle was still climbing, passing decks and towers and the thin horizontal lines of monorail tracks. All Hawser's weight was taken by his fingers, hooked in their gloves of the edge of the ramp door. His arms ached.
"I'm hanging onto the goddamn ramp!"
"You bastards!"
screamed another voice. It was Lam. The ramp started to close. The jerk almost broke Hawser's grip. They were 50 meters up and climbing. He saw the top part of the doors jawing down toward his fingers.
"Mip!" he yelled. "Don't close the door! Leave the ramp where it is and I'll try to get in!"
"Okay,"
Mip said quickly. The ramp stopped, angling up, halting at about 20 degrees. Hawser began swinging his legs from side to side. They were 70-80 meters up, facing away from the wave of wreckage and heading slowly away from it.
"You black bastard, come back!"
Lam bellowed.
"I can't, Lam,"
Mip cried.
"I can't, you're too close!"
"You fat bastard!"
Lam hissed. Light flickered around Hawser. The underside of the shuttle blazed in a dozen places as laser fire hit it. Something slammed into Hawser's left foot on the sole of his boot, and his right leg was kicked out as his leg burned with pain. Mip screamed incoherently. The shuttle started to gather speed, heading back over the megaship and diagonally across it. The air roared around Hawser's body, slowly tearing his grip away.
"Mip, slow down!" he shouted.
"Bastard!"
Lam yelled again. The mist to one side glowed as a fan of short-lived beams incandesced within it. Then the laser fire shifted and the shuttle sparkled again, cracking with 5 or 6 small explosions around the front and nose section. Mip howled. The shuttle increased speed. Hawser was still trying to swing one leg onto the sloped ramp, but the clawed fingers of his gloves were slowly scraping along the roughened surface as his body was slipstreamed back behind the speeding craft. Lam screamed. A high, gurgling sound which went through Hawser's head like an electric shock until the noise snapped off suddenly, replaced for an instant by sharp, cracking, breaking noises. The shuttle raced over the surface of the crashing megaship 100 meters up. Hawser felt the strength ebbing from his fingers and arms. He looked through the helmet visor at the interior of the shuttle only a few meters away as millimeter by millimeter he slipped away from it. The interior flashed once, then an instant later blazed white, blindingly, unbearably. His eyes closed instinctively and a burning yellow light came through his eyelids. His helmet speakers made a sudden, piercing, inhuman noise like a machine screaming, then cut out altogether. The light faded slowly. He opened his eyes. The shuttle interior was still brightly lit, but it was smouldering now too. In the turbulent air whirling in from the open rear doors, wisps of smoke were tugged from scorched seats, singed straps and webbing, and the crisped black skin on Lenny Pobre's exposed face. Shadows seemed to be burned onto the bulkhead in front. Hawser's fingers, one by one, came to the edge of the ramp. My God, he thought, looking at the scorch marks and the smoke. That maniac had a nuke after all. Then the shockwave hit. It slapped him forward, over the ramp and into the shuttle, just before it hit the machine itself, throwing it bucking and bouncing about the sky like a tiny bird caught in a storm. Hawser was rattled about the interior from side to side, trying desperately to grab hold of something to stop himself falling back out through the open rear doors. His hand found some straps and fisted round them with the last of his strength. Back through the doors, through the mist, a huge rolling fireball was climbing slowly into the sky. A noise like every clap of thunder he had ever heard vibrated through the hot, hazed interior of the fleeing machine. The shuttle banked, throwing Hawser against one set of seats. A big tower flashed by the open rear doors, blocking out the fireball as the shuttle continued to turn. The rear doors seemed to try to close, then jammed. Hawser felt heavy and hot inside his suit as the heat from the bomb's flash seeped through from the surfaces which had been exposed to the initial fireball. His right leg hurt badly, somewhere below the knee. He could smell burning. As the shuttle steadied and its course straightened, Hawser got up and limped forward to the door set in the bulkhead, where the outlines of the seats and Lenny Pobre's slumped body, now spread-eagled near the rear doors, were burned in frozen shadows onto the off-white surface of the wall. He opened the door and went through. Mip was in the pilot seat, hunched over the controls. The monitor screens were blank, but the view through the thick polarized glass of the shuttle's windscreen showed cloud, mist, some towers sliding underneath, and open sea beyond, covered with yet more cloud.
"Thought you were dead,"
Mip said, thickly, half turning toward Hawser. Mip looked wounded, crouched in his seat, hunchbacked, eyelids drooped. Sweat glistened on his dark brow. There was smoke in the flight deck, acrid and sweet at once. Hawser took his helmet off and fell into the other seat. He looked down at his right leg. A neat, black-rimmed hole about a centimetre across had been punched through the back of the suit calf, matched by a larger and more ragged hole on the side. He flexed the leg and winced. Just a muscle burn, already cauterized. He could see no blood. He looked at Mip.
"You all right?"
he asked. He already knew the answer. Mip shook his head.
"No," he said in a soft voice. "That lunatic hit me. Leg and my back somewhere."
Hawser looked at the back of Mip's suit, near where it rested against the seat. A hole in the bowl of the seat led to a long, dark scar on the suit's surface. Hawser looked down at the flight deck floor.
"Shit," he said. "This thing's full of holes."
The floor was pitted with craters. 2 were directly under Mip's seat. 1 laser shot had caused that dark scar on the side of the suit. The other must have hit Mip's body.
"Feels like that bastard shot me right up the ass, Hawser,"
Mip said, trying to smile.
He did have a nuke, didn't he? That's when it went off, blew all the electrics away. Only the optic control's still working. Useless damn shuttle.
Mip, let me take over, Hauser said. They were in cloud now. Only a vague, coppery light showed through the crystal screen ahead. Mip shook his head.
Can't. You couldn't fly this thing. With it in this shape.
We've got to go back, Mip. The others might have...
Can't. They'll all be dead,
Mip said, shaking his head and gripping the controls tighter, staring through the screen.
God, this thing's dying.
He looked round the blank monitors, shaking his head slowly.
I can feel it.
Shit, Hauser said, feeling helpless. What about radiation? He said suddenly. It was a truism that in any properly designed suit, if you survived the flash and blast, you'd survive the radiation, but Hauser wasn't sure that his was a properly designed suit. One of the many instruments it lacked was a radiation monitor, and that was a bad sign in itself. Mip looked at a small screen on the console.
Radiation.
He shook his head.
Nothing serious, he said. Low on neutrons.
He grimaced with pain.
Pretty clean bomb. Probably not what that bastard wanted at all. He should take it back to the shop.
Mip gave a small, strangled, despairing laugh. We have to go back, Mip, Hauser said. He tried to imagine Yalson running away from the wreckage with a better start than he and Lam had had. He told himself she'd have made it, that when the bomb had gone off, she'd have been far enough away not to be injured by it, and that the ship would finally stop, the metal glacier of wreckage slowing and halting. But how would she or any of the others get off the megaship, if any of them had survived? He tried the shuttle's communicator, but it was as dead as his suits.
You won't raise them, Mip said, shaking his head. You can't raise the dead. I heard them. They cut off while they were running. I was trying to tell them,
Mip, they changed channels, that was all. Didn't you hear, Cricklin? They swapped channels because Lam was shouting so much. Mip crouched in his seat, shaking his head.
I didn't hear that, he said after a moment. That wasn't what I heard. I was trying to tell them about the ice, the size of it, the height.
He shook his head again.
They're dead, Hauser.
They were well away from us, Mip, Hauser said quietly. At least a kilometer. They probably survived. If they were in shadow, if they'd run when we did, they were further back. They're probably alive, Mip. We've got to go back and get them. Mip shook his head.
Can't, Hauser. They must be dead. Even Nysin went off for a walk after you had all gone. Had to leave without him. Couldn't raise him. They must be dead, all of them.
Mip, Hauser said. It wasn't a very big nuke. Mip laughed, then groaned. He shook his head again.
So what? You didn't see that ice, Hauser. It was...
Just then, the shuttle lurched. Hauser looked quickly to the screen, but there was only the glowing light of the cloud they were flying through all around them.
Oh, God, Mip whispered. We're losing it.
What's wrong? Hauser asked. Mip shrugged painfully.
Everything. I think we're dropping, but I've no altimeter, no airspeed indicator, communicator or nav gear, nothing. Running rough because of all these holes and the doors being open.
We're losing height? Hauser asked, looking at Mip. Mip nodded.
You want to start throwing things out? He said. Well, throw things out. Might get us more height.
The shuttle lurched again. You're serious? Hauser said, starting to get out of the seat. Mip nodded.
We're dropping. I'm serious. Damn. Even if we did go back, we couldn't take this thing over the edge wall. Not even with one or two of us, just...
Mip's voice trailed off. Hauser levered himself painfully out of his seat and through the door. In the passenger compartment there was smoke, mist and noise. The hazy light streamed through the doors. He tried to tear the seats from the walls, but they wouldn't move. He looked at Lenny Pobre's broken body and burned face. The shuttle lurched. For a second, Hauser felt lighter inside his suit. He grabbed Lenny Pobre's suit by the arm and hauled the dead youth to the ramp. He pushed the corpse over the ramp and the limp husk fell, vanishing into the mist below. The shuttle banked one way, then the other, almost throwing Hauser off his feet. He found some bits and pieces, a spare suit helmet, a length of thin rope, an AG harness, and a heavy gun tripod. He threw them out.
He found a small fire extinguisher. He looked round, but there didn't seem to be any flames, and the smoke hadn't got any worse. He held on to the extinguisher and went through to the flight deck. The smoke appeared to be clearing there too.
"How are we doing?" he asked.
Mip shook his head.
"Don't know."
He nodded at the seat Hawser had been sitting in.
"You can unlock that from the deck. Throw it out."
Hawser found the latches securing the seat to the deck. He undid them and dragged the seat through the door to the ramp and threw it out along with the extinguisher.
"There are catches under walls near this bulkhead," Mip called,
then grunted with pain. He went on.
"You can detach the wall seats."
Hawser found the catches and pushed first one line of seats, then the other, complete with straps and webbing, along the rails fixed to the shuttle interior until they rolled out, bouncing on the ramp edge and then spinning away into the glowing mist. He felt the shuttle bank again. The door between the passenger compartment and the flight deck slammed shut. Hawser went forward to it. It was locked.
"Mip!" he shouted.
"Sorry, Hawser."
Mip's voice came weakly from the other side of the door.
"I can't go back. Cricklin would kill me if he isn't dead already. But I couldn't find them. I just couldn't. It was only luck I saw you."
"Mip, don't be crazy. Unlock the door."
Hawser shook it. It wasn't strong. He could break his way through if he had to.
"Can't, Hawser. Don't try to force the door. I'll point her nose straight down. I swear it. We can't be that high above the sea anyway. I can hardly keep her flying as it is. If you want, try closing the doors manually. There should be an access panel somewhere on the rear wall."
"Mip, for God's sake, where are you going? They're going to blow the place up in a few days. We can't fly forever."
"Oh, we'll ditch before that."
Mip's voice came from behind the closed door. He sounded tired.
"We'll ditch before they blow the orbital up, Hawser. Don't you worry. This thing's dying."
"But where are you going?" Hawser repeated, shouting at the door.
"Don't know, Hawser. The far side, maybe? Even out? I don't know. Just away."
There was a thump, as though something had fallen to the floor, and Mip cursed. The shuttle judded, heeling over briefly. "What is it?" Hawser asked anxiously.
"Nothing," Mip said. "I dropped the med kit, that's all."
"Shit," Hawser said under his breath, and sat down, back against the bulkhead.
"Don't worry, Hawser. I'll do what I can."
"Yes, Mip," Hawser said.
He got to his feet again, ignoring the ache of exhaustion in both legs and the stabbing pain in his right calf, and went to the rear of the shuttle. He looked for an access panel, found one, and prized it open. It revealed another fire extinguisher. He threw it out too. On the other wall, the panel led to a hand crank. Hawser twisted the grip. The doors started to close slowly, then jammed. He strained at the lever until it snapped. He swore and threw it out as well. Just then, the shuttle came clear of the mist. Hawser looked down and saw the ruffled surface of a grey sea where slow waves rolled and broke. The bank of mist lay behind them, an indeterminate grey curtain beneath which the sea disappeared. The sunlight slanted across the layered mist and hazy clouds filled the sky. Hawser watched the broken handle tumble down toward the sea, becoming smaller and smaller. It stroked a mark of white across the water, then it was gone. He reckoned they were about 100 meters above the sea. The shuttle banked, forcing Hawser to grab the side of the door. The craft turned to head almost parallel to the cloud bank. Hawser went to the bulkhead and banged on the door.
"Mip, I can't get the doors closed."
"It's all right,"
the other man replied faintly.
"Mip, open the door. Don't be crazy.
Leave me alone, Hawser. Leave me alone, understand?"
"God damn," Hawser said to himself.
He went back to the open doors, buffeted by the wind curling back in from the slipstream. They seemed to be heading away from the edge wall, judging by the angle of the sun. Behind them lay nothing but sea and clouds. There was no sign of the Olna Drekka or any other craft or ship. The seemingly flat horizon to either side disappeared into a haze. The ocean gave no impression of being concave, only vast. Hawser tried to stick his head round the corner of the shuttle's open door to see where they were going. The rush of air forced his head back before he could take a proper look, and the craft lurched again slightly. But he had an impression of another horizon as flat and featureless as that on either side. He got further back into the shuttle and tried his communicator, but there was nothing from his helmet speakers. All the circuits were dead. Everything seemed to have been knocked out by the electromagnetic pulse from the explosion on the megaship. Hawser considered taking the suit off and throwing it out too, but he was already cold, and if he took the suit off, he'd be virtually naked. He would keep the device on unless they started losing height suddenly. He shivered, and his whole body ached. He would sleep. There was nothing he could do for now, and his body needed rest. He considered changing, but decided against it. He closed his eyes. He saw Yalsin, as he had imagined her, running on the megaship, and opened his eyes again. He told himself she was all right, just fine, then closed his eyes once more. Maybe by the time he woke, they'd be out from under the layers of magnetized dust in the upper atmosphere, in the tropical or even just temperate zones, rather than the Arctic region. But that would probably mean only that they would finally ditch in warm water, not cold. He couldn't imagine MIP or the shuttle holding together long enough to complete a journey right across the orbital. Assume it was 30,000 kilometers across. They were making perhaps 300 per hour. His head full of changing figures, Hawser slipped into sleep. His last coherent thought was that they just weren't going fast enough and probably couldn't. They would still be flying over the Circle Sea toward land when the culture blew the whole orbital into a 14 million kilometer halo of light and dust. Hawser woke, rolling around inside the shuttle. In the first few blurred seconds of his waking, he thought he'd already tumbled out of the rear door of the shuttle and was falling through the air. Then his head cleared, and he found himself lying spread-eagled on the floor of the rear compartment, watching the blue sky outside tilt as the shuttle banked. The craft seemed to be travelling more slowly than he remembered. He could see nothing from the rear view out of the doors except blue sky, blue sea, and a few puffy white clouds, so he stuck his head round the side of the door. The buffeting wind was warm, and over in the direction the shuttle was banking lay a small island. Hawser looked at it incredulously. It was tiny, surrounded by smaller atolls and reefs showing pale green through the shallow water, and it had a single small mountain sticking up from the concentric circles of lush green vegetation and bright yellow sand. The shuttle dipped and levelled, straightening on its course for the island. Hawser brought his head back in, resting the muscles of his neck and shoulder after the exertion of holding his head out in the slipstream. The shuttle slowed yet more, dipping again. A slight juddering vibrated through the craft's frame. Hawser saw a torus of lime-coloured water appear in the sea behind the shuttle. He stuck his head round the side of the door again and saw the island just ahead and about 50 metres below. Small figures were running up the beach which the shuttle was approaching. A group of the humans were heading across the sand for the jungle, carrying what looked like a huge pyramid of golden sand on a sort of litter or stretcher held on poles between them. Hawser watched the scene slide by underneath. There were small fires on the beach and long canoes. At one end of the beach, where the trees cut down toward the water, there squatted a broad-backed, shovel-nosed shuttle, perhaps two or three times the size of the cat's. The shuttle flew over the island through some vague grey pillars of smoke. The beach was almost clear of people. The last few, who looked thin and almost naked, ran into the cover of the trees as though afraid of the craft flying over them. One figure lay sprawled on the sand near the module. Hawser caught a glimpse of one human figure more fully clothed than the others, not running but standing and pointing up toward him, pointing toward the shuttle flying over the island, with something in his hand. Then the top of the small mountain appeared just underneath the open shuttle door, blocking off the view. Hawser heard a series of sharp reports like small, hard explosions. "Mip!" he shouted, going to the closed door.
"We've had it, Hawser,"
Mip said weakly from the other side. There was a sort of despairing jocularity in his voice.
"Even the natives aren't friendly."
"They looked frightened," Hawser said. The island was disappearing behind. They weren't turning back, and Hawser felt the shuttle speeding up.
"One of them had a gun,"
Mip said. He coughed, then moaned. "Did you see that shuttle?" Hawser asked.
"Yeah, I saw it."
"I think we should go back, Mip," Hawser said. "I think we ought to turn round."
"No," Mip said. "No, I don't think we ought to. I don't think that's a good idea, Hawser. I didn't like the look of the place."
"Mip, it looked dry. What more do you want?" Hawser looked at the view through the rear doors. The island was nearly a kilometre away already, and the shuttle was still increasing speed, gaining height all the time.
"Got to keep going, Hawser.
Head for the coast. Mip, we'll never get there. It'll take us 4 days at least, and the culture's going to blow this place apart in three.
There was silence from the far side of the door. Hawser shook its light, grubby surface with his hand.
Just leave it, Hawser!
Mip screamed. Hawser hardly recognized the man's hoarse, shrill voice.
Just leave it! I'll kill us both, I swear!
The shuttle suddenly tilted, pointing its nose at the sky and its open doors at the sea. Hawser started to slide back, his feet slipping on the shuttle's floor. He jammed the suit fingers into the wall slot the seats had been attached to, hanging there as the shuttle started to stall in its steep climb.
All right, Mip, he shouted, all right!
The shuttle fell, side-slipping, throwing Hawser forward and against the bulkhead. He was suddenly heavy as the craft bottomed out of its short dive. The sea slithered underneath, only 50 or so meters below.
Just leave me alone, Hawser!
Mip's voice said.
Okay, Mip, Hawser said. Okay.
The shuttle rose a little, gaining altitude and increasing speed. Hawser went back away from the bulkhead, which separated him from the flight deck and Mip. Hawser shook his head and went to stand by the open door, looking back toward the island with its lime shallows, grey rock, green-blue foliage and band of yellow sand. It all slowly shrank, the frame of the open shuttle doors filling with more and more sea and sky as the island lost itself in the haze. He wondered what he could do, and knew there was only one course of action. There had been a shuttle on that island. It could hardly be in a worse state than the one he was in now, and their chances of being rescued at the moment were virtually nil. He turned round to look at the flimsy door leading to the flight deck, still holding on to the edge of the rear door, the warm, buffeting air spilling in around him. He wondered whether just to charge straight in or to try to reason with Mip first. While he was still thinking about it, the shuttle gave a shudder, then started to fall like a stone toward the sea. Chapter 6. The Eaters. Hawser was weightless for a second. He felt himself caught by the eddying wind swirling through the rear doors, drawing him toward them. He grabbed at the channel in the wall he'd held onto earlier. The shuttle dipped its nose, and the roar of the wind increased. Hawser floated, his eyes closed, his fingers jammed into the wall slot, waiting for the crash. But instead, the shuttle levelled out again, and he was back on his feet. Mip! He shouted, staggering forward to the door. He felt the craft turning and glanced out through the rear doors. They were still falling.
It's gone, Hawser,
Mip said faintly.
I've lost it.
He sounded weak, calmly despairing.
I'm turning back for the island. We won't get there, but we're going to hit in a few moments. You'd best get down by this bulkhead and brace yourself. I try to put her down as softly as I can.
Mip, Hawser said, sitting down on the floor with his back to the bulkhead. Is there anything I can do?
Nothing,
Mip said.
Here we go. Sorry, Hawser. Brace yourself.
Hawser did exactly the opposite, letting himself go limp. The air, roaring through the rear doors, howled in his ears. The shuttle shook underneath him. The sky was blue. He caught a glimpse of waves. He kept just enough tension in his back to keep his head against the bulkhead surface. Then he heard Mip shout, not words, just a shout of fear, an animal noise. The shuttle crashed, slamming into something, forcing Hawser hard back against the wall, then releasing him. The craft raised its nose slightly. Hawser felt light for a moment, saw waves and white spray through the open rear doors. Then the waves went. He saw sky and closed his eyes as the shuttle's nose dipped again. The craft smashed into the waves, crashing to a stop in the water. Hawser felt himself squashed into the bulkhead as though by the foot of some gigantic animal. The wind was forced out of him, blood roared, the suit bit at him. He was shaken and flattened, and then, just as the impact seemed to be over, another shock sledgehammered into his back and neck and head, and suddenly he was blind. The next thing he knew, there was water everywhere about him. He was gasping and spluttering, striking out in the darkness and hitting his hands off hard, sharp, broken surfaces. He could hear water gurgling and his own choked breath frothing. He blew water out of his mouth and coughed. He was floating in a bubble of air, in darkness, in warm water. Most of his body seemed to be aching, each limb and part clamouring with its own special message of pain. He felt gingerly round the small space he was trapped in. The bulkhead had collapsed, He was, at last, in the flight deck area with Mip. He found the other man's body, crushed between seat and instrument panel, trapped and still, half a metre under the surface of the water. His head, which Hawser could feel by reaching down between the seat headrest and what felt like the innards of the main monitor screen, moved too easily in the neck of the suit, and the forehead had been crushed. The water was rising higher. The air was escaping through the smashed nose of the shuttle, floating and bobbing bow up in the sea. Hawser knew he would have to swim down and back through the shuttle's rear section and out through the rear doors, otherwise he'd be trapped. He breathed as deeply as he could, despite the pain, for about a minute, while the rising water level gradually forced his head into the angle between the top of the craft's instrument panel and the flight deck ceiling. He dived. He forced his way down, past the wreckage of the crushed seat Mip had died in, and past the twisted panels of light material which had made up the bulkhead. He could see light, vaguely green-grey, forming a rectangle beneath him. Air, trapped in his suit, bubbled round him along his legs, upward to his feet. He was slowed for a moment, buoyed up by the air in his boots, and for a second he thought he wasn't going to make it, that he was going to hang there upside down and drown. Then the air bubbled out through the holes in his boots, punched there by Lam's laser, and Hawser sank. He struggled down through the water to the rectangle of light, then swam through the open rear doors and into the shimmering green depths of the water under the shuttle. He kicked and went up, breaking out into the waves with a gasp, sucking warm, fresh air into his lungs. He felt his eyes adjust to the slanted but still bright sunlight of late afternoon. He grabbed hold of the shuttle's dented, punctured nose, sticking above the water by about 2 meters, and looked around, trying to see the island, but without success. Still just treading water and letting his battered body and brain recover, Hawser watched the up-tilted nose of the craft sink lower in the water and tip slowly forward, so that the shuttle gradually floated almost level in the waves, its top surface just awash. The changer, his arm muscles straining and hurting, eventually hauled himself onto the top of the shuttle and lay there like a beached fish. He started to shut off the pain signals, like a weary servant picking up the litter of breakables after an employer's destructive rage. It was only lying there, with small waves washing over the top surface of the shuttle's fuselage, that he realized that all the water he had been coughing up and swallowing was fresh. It hadn't occurred to him that the Circle Sea would be anything other than salt, like most planetary oceans. But in fact, there was not even the slightest tang of it, and he congratulated himself that at least he would not die of thirst. He stood up carefully in the centre of the shuttle roof, waves breaking round his feet. He looked around and could see the island, just. It looked very small and far away in the early evening light, and while there was a faint warm breeze blowing more or less toward the island, he had no idea which way any currents might be taking him. He sat down, then lay back, letting the waters of the Circle Sea wash over the flat surface beneath him and break in small lines of surf against his much-damaged suit. After a while, he just fell asleep, not really meaning to, but not stopping himself when he realized that he was, telling himself to sleep for only an hour or so. He woke up to see the sun, though still high in the sky, looking dark red as it shone through the layers of dust above the distant edge wall. He got to his feet again. The shuttle didn't seem to have sunk any lower in the water. The island was still far away, but it looked a little nearer than it had earlier. The currents, or the winds, such as they were, seemed to be carrying him in roughly the right direction. He sat down again. The air was still warm. He thought of taking the suit off, but decided against it. It was uncomfortable, but perhaps he would get too cold without it. He lay back again. He wondered where Yalson was now. Had she survived Lam's bomb and the wreck? He hoped so. He thought she probably had. He couldn't imagine her dead or dying. It was little enough to go on, and he refused to believe he was superstitious, but not being able to imagine her dead was somehow comforting. She'd survive. Take more than a tactical nuke and a billion-ton ship impacting a berg the size of a small continent to polish that girl off. He found himself smiling, remembering her. He would have spent more time thinking about Yalson, but there was something else he had to think about as well. Tonight, he would change. It was all he could do. Probably by now it was irrelevant. Craiglin was either dead or, if surviving, unlikely ever to meet Hawser again. But the changer had prepared for the transformation. His body was waiting for it, and he could think of nothing better to do. The situation, he told himself, was far from hopeless. He wasn't badly injured. He seemed to be heading for the island where the shuttle might still be, and if he could make it in time, there was always Evenauth and that damage game. Anyway, the culture might be looking for him by now, so it wouldn't do to keep the same identity for too long. What the hell, he thought. He would change. He would go to sleep as the Hawser the others knew him as, and he would wake up as a copy of the captain of the Clear Air Turbulence. He prepared his bruised and aching body for the alteration as best he could, relaxing muscles and readying glands and groups of cells, sending deliberate signals from brain to body and face through nerves that only changes possessed. He watched the sun, dimming through red stages somewhere low over the ocean. Now he would sleep. Sleep and become Kraytlin. Take on yet another identity, another shape to add to the many he had assumed already during his life. Maybe there was no point. Maybe he was only taking this new shape on to die in. But, he thought, what have I got to lose? Hawser watched the falling, darkening red eye of the sun until he entered the sleep of changing, and in that changing trance, though his eyes were closed and beneath their lids also altering, he seemed to see that dying glare still. Animal eyes. Predator's eyes. Caged behind them, looking out. Never sleeping, being three people, ownership, rifle and ship and company. Not much yet, maybe, but one day, with just a little luck, no more than everybody else had a right to, one day he would show them he knew how good he was, he knew what he was fit for and who was fit for him. The rest were just tokens. They were his because they were under his command. It was his ship, after all. The women especially, just game pieces. They could come and go, and he didn't care. All you had to do with any of them was share their danger, and they thought you were wonderful. They couldn't see that for him there was no danger. He had a lot left to do in life. He knew he wasn't going to die some stupid, squalid little combat death. The galaxy one day would know his name, and either mourn him or curse him, when eventually he did have to die. He hadn't decided yet whether it would be mourn or curse. Maybe it depended on how the galaxy treated him in the meantime. All he needed was the tiniest break, just the sort of thing the others had had. The leaders of the bigger, more successful, better known, more feared and respected free companies. They must have had them. They might seem greater than he was now, but one day they would look up to him. Everybody would. All would know his name. Kraytlin. Hawser woke in the dawn light, still lying on the wave-washed shuttle roof, like something washed up and spread upon a table. He was half awake, half asleep. It was colder, the light was thinner and more blue, but nothing else had changed. He started to drift back to sleep again, away from pain and lost hopes. Nothing else had changed. Only him. He had to swim for the island. He had woken for the second time the same morning, feeling different, better, rested. The sun was angling up and out of the overhead haze. The island was closer, but he was going past it. The currents were taking him and the shuttle away now, having swept no closer than 2 kilometres to the group of reefs and sandbanks round the isle. He cursed himself for sleeping so long. He got out of the suit. It was useless now, and deserved to be ditched, and left it lying on the still just-awash shuttle roof. He was hungry. His stomach rumbled, but he felt fit and ready for the swim. He estimated it was about 3 kilometres. He dived in and struck out powerfully. His right leg hurt where he'd been hit by Lam's laser, and his body still ached in places, but he could do it. He knew he could. He looked back once after he'd swum for a few minutes. He could see the suit, but not the shuttle. The empty suit was like the abandoned cocoon of some metamorphosed animal, riding opened and empty-seeming just above the surface of the waves behind. He turned away and kept swimming. The island came closer, but very slowly. The water was warm at first, but it seemed to get colder, and the aches in his body increased. He ignored them, switching them off, but he could feel himself slowing, and he knew that he'd started off too fast. He paused, treading water for a moment, then, after drinking a little of the warm, fresh water, set off again, stroking more deliberately and steadily for the grey tower of the distant island. He told himself how lucky he'd been. The shuttle crash hadn't injured him badly, though the aches still plagued him, like noisy relatives locked in a distant room disturbing his concentration. The warm water, though apparently getting colder, was fresh, so that he could drink from it and wouldn't dehydrate. Yet it crossed his mind that he would have been more buoyant had it been salty. He kept going. It ought to have been easy, but it was getting more difficult all the time. He stopped thinking about it. He concentrated on moving, the slow, steady, rhythmic beat of arms and legs forcing him through the water. Up waves, over, down, up, over, down. Under my own power, he told himself. Under my own power. The mountain on the island grew larger very slowly. He felt as though he was building it, as though the effort required to make it appear larger in his sight was the same as if he was toiling to construct that peak, heap it up, rock by rock, with his own hands. 2 kilometres. Then 1. The sun angled, rose. Eventually, the outer reefs and shallows, he passed them in a daze into shallower water. A sea of aching, an ocean of exhaustion. He swam toward the beach, through a fan of waves and surf radiating from the reef gap he'd swum through, and felt as though he'd never taken the suit off, as though he wore it still, and it was stiff with rust or age, or filled with heavy water or wet sand, dragging, stiffening, pulling him back. He could hear waves breaking on the beach, and when he looked up, he could see people on it. Thin, dark people, dressed in rags, gathered round tents and fires or walking between them. Some were in the water ahead of him, carrying baskets, large openwork baskets which they held on their waists, gathering things from the sea as they waded through it, putting what they collected in their baskets. They hadn't seen him, so he swam on, making a slow, crawling motion with his arms and kicking feebly with his legs. The people harvesting the sea didn't appear to notice him. They kept on wading through the surf, stooping occasionally to pick from the sands underneath, their eyes sweeping and probing, scanning and searching, but too close in, not seeing him. His stroke slowed to a gasping, dying crawl. He could not lift his hands free of the water, and his legs stayed paralysed. Then, through the surf noise, like something from a dream, he heard several people shouting nearby and splashes coming close. He was still swimming weakly when another wave lifted him, and he saw several of the skinny people clad in loincloths and tattered tunics wading through the water toward him. They helped Hawser in through the breaking waves, over sun-streaked shallows and onto the golden sands. He lay there while the thin and haggard people crowded round. They talked quietly to each other in a language he hadn't heard before. He tried to move, but couldn't. His muscles felt like lengths of limp rag.
"Hello," he croaked.
He tried it in all the languages he knew, but none seemed to work. He looked into the faces of the people around him. They were human, but that word covered so many different species throughout the galaxy, it was a continuing subject for debate who was and who wasn't human. As in all too many matters, the consensus of opinion was starting to resemble what the culture had to say on the subject. The culture would lay down the law, except, of course, that the culture didn't have any real laws, about what being human was, or how intelligent a particular species was, while at the same time making clear that pure intelligence didn't really mean much on its own, or on how long people should live, though only as a rough guide, naturally. And people would accept these things without question, because everybody believed the culture's own propaganda, that it was fair, unbiased, disinterested, concerned only with absolute truth, and so on. So, were these people around him really human? They were about Hawser's height. They seemed to have roughly the same bone structure, bilateral symmetry and respiratory system, and their faces, though each was different, all had eyes, mouth, nose and ears. But they all looked thinner than they ought to have been, and their skin, regardless of hue or shade, looked somehow diseased. Hawser lay still. He felt very heavy again, but at least he was on dry land. On the other hand, it didn't look as though there was much food on the island, judging by the state of the bodies around him. He assumed that was why they were so thin. He raised his head weakly and tried to see through the clumps of thin legs toward the shuttlecraft he had seen earlier. He could just see the top of the machine sticking up above one of the large canoes beached on the sands. Its rear doors were open. A smell wafted under Hawser's nose and made him feel sick. He put his head down onto the sand again, exhausted. The talking stopped, and the people turned, their thin, tanned or, anyway, dark bodies shuffling round to face up the beach. A space opened in their ranks just above Hawser's head, and try as he might, he couldn't get up on one elbow or swivel his head to see what or who was coming. He lay and waited. Then the people to his right all drew back, and a line of 8 men appeared on that side, holding a long pole together in their left hands. Their other arms stuck out for balance. It was the litter he had seen being carried into the jungle the day before, when the shuttle had overflown the island. He watched to see what it held. Two lines of men turned the litter so that it faced Hawser and set it down. Then all 16 sat down, looking exhausted. Hawser stared. On the litter sat the most enormous, obscenely fat human Hawser had ever seen. He had mistaken the giant for a pyramid of golden sand the previous day when he had seen the litter and its huge burden from the cat's shuttle. Now he could see that his first impression had been close in shape, if not in substance. Whether the vast cone of human flesh belonged to a male or a female, Hawser couldn't tell. Great mammary-like folds of naked flesh spilled from the creature's upper and middle chest, but they drooped over even more enormous waves of nude, hairless torso fat, which lay partly cradled in the vast beefs of the giant's akimboed legs, and partly overflowing those to droop into the canvas surface of the litter. Hawser could see no stitch of clothing on the monster, but no trace of genitals either. Whatever they were quite buried under rolls of golden brown flesh. Hawser looked up to the head. Rising from a thick cone of neck, gazing out over concentric ramparts of chins, a bald dome of puffy flesh contained a limp and rambling length of pale lips, a small button nose, and slits where eyes must be. The head sat on its layers of neck, shoulder, and chest fat like a great golden bell on top of a many-decked temple. The sweat-glistened giant suddenly moved its hands, rolling them round on the end of the bloated, fat-bound balloons of its arms until the merely chubby fingers met and clasped as tightly as their size would.